Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Macy's says it will close 100 stores. Walmart plans to buy the online retailer Jet.com for $3 billion. Soon you'll see Amazon-branded airplanes in the sky. They're the latest addition to the company's new transportation fleet. The shopping environment is changing rapidly. This hour on Point, what does the future look like for the U.S. retail sector? You can join us on air or online. Tell us how you shop. Do you like looking through the racks at stores? Do you like touching and feeling and trying things on before you purchase something? Or do you buy everything online? Or do you make some trips to the store for some purchases and you turn to your iPad for others? Tell us about your shopping strategy. We want to hear how stores can appeal to you. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Sarah Halzack. She's a national retail reporter for The Washington Post. You can link to her articles at onpointradio.org. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Sasha.
And also with me from New York is Mark Cohen, director of retail sales at Columbia Business School. He's also former chairman and CEO of Sears Canada, of Bradley's, and of Lazarus Department Stores. And Lazarus, for those not familiar with that name, as native Ohioans like I am, is a Midwest retail chain that merged with Macy's. Mark, welcome to you, too.
Hello.
So we have a lot of interesting retail news that happened in just the past week that I'd like to tick through so the two of you can explain to us what happened and why. And I think we should first talk about Macy's, one of the big legacy department stores that has historically been anchors for malls. 100 stores closing, Macy's says. That's, I think, 15% of the store total. Sarah Halzack, tell us why these stores are shutting down.
Yeah, so Macy's is essentially moving here, making an aggressive bid to say, in this era where more and more people are shopping online, we simply have too many stores, and we need to pull back the ones that are less productive and really focus on the ones that we can make money from.
So when they say too many stores, is that because they say that they're underperforming stores? Are they just looking at sales numbers and thinking these aren't working for us?
Yeah, there are stores where they've been seeing the productivity and the sales volume slide. But overall, when you think about the big 30,000-foot view, what they're seeing here is that more and more of our shopping is moving online and that they don't need to have, you know, five stores in one metropolitan area. Perhaps they only need to have two or three. When you're just in a hurry to buy a birthday gift that you forgot to buy for a party on a Saturday afternoon, you need somewhere to run to. But when you're doing big trips like back-to-school shopping, maybe you're doing that online and you don't need that Macy's right around the corner anymore.
I want to hear a little piece of sound from CNBC. This goes back to last Thursday, shortly after the Macy's closure was announced. And the stock of Macy's surged when that happened. So listen to this.
They're going to close 100 stores of their current 728, saying this is a proactive decision. Most of these stores are cash flow positive at this point. It does represent about $1 billion worth of sales.
So, Sarah Halzack, if these stores are cash flow positive in some cases, why close them down?
Because you have to look over the long term here, and they see the writing on the wall. Americans, we simply have too many stores for the way people are shopping today, and they know they have to gird themselves against that. They know there's a future where more and more of those dollars are moving online. And also, if they can take the workers that are in those stores and move them to another store in the same market, perhaps they can deliver better service to the people who are shopping in store there, and perhaps they can use some of those workers to fill online orders from the stores. So this is really about right-sizing their store fleet for an era where things have just changed very dramatically.
Mark Cohen, do you look at it that way? Is this a proactive move?
There's a bit of a backstory here. Macy's has, you know, something over 700 stores. Several hundred of those stores though they may be cash flow positive, have not done well enough to justify investment, and therefore they've become tired and worn out. Increasingly so over the last 5 to 7 years. So this is a reckoning that they have finally faced up to. Their overall brick-and-mortar business has been very, very tough for at least the last year, if not the last year and a half. And they're facing up to the fact that these stores will never be renovated. These stores are housed in malls that are not fully tenanted, that are losing Sears, will likely lose JCPenney, and others. And so they're getting out in front of the inevitability of this store fleet, which is in need of an enormous rationalization. I suspect there's a lot more bad news coming at some point. You know, it's not just 100. I think they announced 40 stores to close last year, this year and next. So now we're up to 140, and if I had to guess, there's at least another 150 to 200 more to come.
Now, Macy's does do online sales. What's your view of how its internet business matches up with its in-store business?
Their internet business, they say, has been outstanding. It's been growing very rapidly. When they first began doing business on the internet, they were very happy to say, and it was probably completely accurate, that their internet customer was spending a lot more money in their stores than a typical customer who did not shop on the internet. And that observation held true for some period of time. But in my opinion, what's happening now is their internet business is increasingly fueled by their customers who are no longer shopping in their stores or who are shopping far less frequently. And so the internet has become an internal diversion, if you will, and in that regard, it's somewhat destructive financially.
Two On Point listeners have posted comments on Facebook that have very different takes on Macy's, and I want to read them both to you and have you weigh in on this. One is from a listener named Ty Clark, and he writes, I only go to Macy's when my family has like 80% coupons, plus stuff is on clearance, and the ridiculously overpriced stuff goes from $89.99 to like $9.99 plus tax. Those are his likes I'm reading, by the way. So there's someone who's basically saying, I only go when I know I can get a good deal. Someone else, this is Maximiliano Velez Meja. He says, online stores, outlets, and fast fashion obliterated these department stores. Macy's, you are still in my heart. So Sarah Halzack, there we have two totally different takes. You know, someone who has almost no use for malls unless they think they can get something dirt cheap, and someone who seems to really miss them. Now, that's hard for stores to know how to accommodate their customers when people have very divergent views like that.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And that's why we see retailers trying to do it all. And that's a hard thing to do. It's interesting what Ty said about the coupons. You know, Macy's is in this tough position now where they've really sort of trained people to expect that kind of cocaine hit of deals that every time you go in there, you're going to be able to get 20% off, 30% off. You're going to really be able to feel like you had a score. Unfortunately, that is creating some challenges for them. For example, last week we saw Michael Kors and Coach both saying they're going to be pulling out of some department stores in some way. So Coach is taking its products out of 250 department stores overall. And Michael Kors is saying, we don't want to be on your friends and family deals anymore. We don't want to be on your coupons because they feel like it cheapens their brand. And so Macy's here has this challenge of, okay, customers expect this kind of discounting from us, and it's perhaps one of the best ways to get them in the door. On the other hand, some of the brands that bring our store cachet and luster don't want to be a part of that. It's a tricky thing for them to balance.
We have a number of callers who want to weigh in. Let's go to some of them. This is Eric calling from Kettering, Ohio. Eric, welcome to On Point. And what's your thought as you listen to this conversation about how people shop these days differently than they used to?
I just think of it's kind of from a cultural aspect since, 2008, 2009, the Great Recession, that this is just the kind of the way things are. Like somebody had said earlier, they won't shop at Macy's unless they have the coupon. I'm the same way, and I'm sure a lot of other people are as well, that they won't go in unless there's a sale. So, I mean, I used to shop at these stores 20 years ago. I shop at them now. Everything's on sale now. And, that's kind of, the rise in popularity at TJ Maxx is indicative of that because everything is priced at that level already. So there'll need to be another cultural shift, I feel, before we kind of move on from this, where it is, I don't know. But, another boom period, perhaps. That's the only thing I can think of.
Eric, I would
say it would go back to the period of mega malls, but, we'll see.
Your comment, Eric, about everything being on sale, I think is actually really important to this conversation. Mark Cohen, maybe you can weigh in here, because there is a feeling that many people only feel like they want to buy things on sale. They will not pay full price. But when we're supposedly getting things on sale, is this really a big game? You know, that supposed original price that is crossed out on the price tag, was it ever that much, and was anyone ever really going to buy it at that much?
Well, back in the day, regular pricing had a significant amount of integrity. And stores that were promotional and that were successful would typically have a balance of sale of regular price sales to promotional price sales of some 35-65, the 35 being promotional sales. That's long gone. Now, Macy's has succumbed, along with others, to the fatal attraction of promotional pricing. Unfortunately, most consumers readily migrate to a deal. Why wouldn't they? When the deal feels like it looks like it was the same deal as last time, the deal has to get better. When you've run out of a savings story in the headline, you know, you're at 50 or 60% off, how do you get the customer's attention? Well, you assign a coupon, or you come up with some other added promotional trick like Macy's Money or something of that sort. And so the customer who has always had a value orientation now has a tremendous value orientation. Nearly every customer shopping in the middle market avoids paying regular price for anything, and they can get away with that because there's always something available promotionally. Macy's is stuck because, you know, there's only 52 weeks a year to promote. There's only 104 events that you can present throughout those 52, and they've clearly run out of the calendar. This closing of stores is just one of a whole host of very challenging remedies that they're going to have to come up with if they're going to right the ship.
And Sarah Halzack, if about 20 seconds, could you tell us if you look with great skepticism at supposed markdown sales, even at some of the big discount retailers?
You know, it's hard not to these days after we've all gotten so used to seeing these emails in our inbox touting these sales. But a lot of customers still look for them, and retailers are trying to provide them in a sensible way.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about changes in how people shop. Macy's is closing 100 stores. Walmart is buying the small, unprofitable online retailer, Jet.com, and paying a great amount of money for it, $3 billion. Malls are looking like mausoleums often. Join this conversation. If you're in the retail business, tell us what you're doing differently or innovatively to try to attract customers. If you shop, tell us if you're surfing for your purchases. Do you like to jump in the car to shop for back-to-school clothes? We're talking with Sarah Halzack, national retail reporter for The Washington Post, and with Mark Cohen, director of retail sales at Columbia Business School. Mark also has extensive experience working for department stores. He's the former chairman and CEO of Sears Canada, of Bradley's, and of Lazarus Department Stores. And Sarah and Mark, I just want to listen to a little piece of sound to remind us of the role of Macy's in culture, really, sort of how legacy this department store is. Of course, it has its famous Thanksgiving Day parade in New York City. And here is some of NBC's past coverage from this past Thanksgiving.
Join us for the Great American Thanksgiving Day tradition. The streets of New York City are lined with millions of spectators, and holiday cheer is in the air.
So for so long, Macy's was an anchor store of many department stores. Now a piece of sound from a very different part of the retail sector. This is Bloomberg's Shannon Pettypiece, and she was interpreting the move last week by Walmart to buy Jet.com. It's a one-year-old startup, and Walmart paid $3 billion for it.
I don't think desperate is too strong of a word, actually. I mean, they have poured billions into their online operations, hired thousands of engineers, and yet we've seen quarter after quarter online growth slowing while Amazon is just growing at a breakneck pace. I think spending $3 billion, I mean, I personally think pretty much everyone overpays for deals, but $3 billion for a one-year-old company, that I would be shocked. Everyone would be shocked if it's making a profit.
Sarah Halzack, your reaction to hearing that Walmart bought this, again, one-year-old, hadn't made a profit, its original business model it kind of bailed on. What do you think when you hear that Amazon pays $3 billion for a company like that?
Well, I think when you hear that Walmart bought Jet for $3 billion, it's particularly shocking when you put it in these terms of the price tag of Walmart's other investment in online initiatives. So last year, they made this big announcement that they were going to spend $2 billion on in-house stuff, on building out their fulfillment centers, on investing in their buy online, pick up in store programs. And then you see that this is a price tag quite a bit bigger than that. For, as Shannon mentioned earlier, this relatively relatively nascent company with a business model that didn't really work. So it is surprising. That said, you can kind of see some threads of what Walmart is trying to do here. So according to some market research data, Jet has pretty affluent customers, and only one-fifth of them overlap with Walmart customers. So as it tries to branch out and court a different kind of shopper online, you can see how perhaps they were eyeing those kinds of figures with optimism.
For listeners who aren't familiar with this website, we should give them a little background, because you may hear Jet.com and think flight or travel, but it's not. It's an online shopping site. You mentioned, Sarah, a failed business model. This was this plan to charge a $50 annual membership fee, which would be the primary or sole source of profits. They decided that customers weren't going to pay that fee, so they gave it up. So, Mark Cohen, your sense on what does Walmart gain by buying such a small company that appears to still be trying to figure out how it can make money?
Well, I'd like to amplify Shannon's comment. Shannon from Bloomberg. I think Walmart just threw $3 billion out the window. They shredded the bills. They tossed them out. They'll never be seen again. I think there's two underlying reasons to acquire companies. One is to use outside organizations, outside talent, outside capability as building blocks to a larger successful strategy. That's the philosophy that Apple has used for many years and has done so very successfully.
Buying expertise, essentially.
Yes, and buying capacity, and typically at rather modest prices. And then there are the Hail Mary passes, and I would describe this deal that Walmart did with Jet.com as a Hail Mary pass that's not going to be caught. Other Hail Mary passes would be, for example, the Hewlett-Packard acquisition of Compaq. Enormously expensive, failed almost upon arrival. Microsoft recently bought Nokia, another extraordinary failure. Sears, Roebuck bought Lands' End some years ago for $2 billion. That went nowhere. And, of course, the Target acquisition of real estate in Canada. They purchased a chain's real estate called Zellers. That turned out to be a $7.6 billion write-off. These desperate attempts to gain legitimacy or capability or capacity to acquire customers who are not part of your own portfolio typically fail, and it's just shocking. It's even more shocking because Jet.com, which is a brand new company, has no pathway to profitability as it's currently constituted. And though they may have more affluent customers than Walmart or Amazon, the number of customers they're doing business with is insignificant. They also have very, very few products to offer relative to Amazon. I mean, they have something like 4 or 5 million products purportedly to sell. Amazon has 600 million. So, I think this is an expression of, to Shannon's point, desperation, and I'm shocked that this CEO and his board would have taken this sort of bait.
You know, it's interesting to call it desperation, because we should note here that Walmart, of course, this purchase, as we've talked about, is intended to try to beef up its online sales. But yet Walmart already is the second largest online retailer. The problem is just that it is so far behind Amazon, which is just this beast in the market that it's trying to catch up. So, Sarah, your sense of whether this purchase can let Walmart leapfrog ahead, as it seems to want to do, and try to be more of a competitor with Amazon?
You know, I think the idea of it leapfrogging ahead of Amazon is very hard to imagine at this point. I think Walmart's e-commerce sales last year were $13.7 billion. You stack that up against the $99 billion that Amazon pulled in. That's that would be a huge leap. But I do think that there is some potential here. Jet has some interesting back-end technology. They have built this pricing model that is not based on the individual item, but it's built on the total basket. So the prices that you see are based on the unique collection of items that you're purchasing. And there's potential for Walmart to think about that technology, think about that algorithm in a unique and interesting way. And there's potential for Walmart to use its supply chain muscle to help Jet improve its own capabilities and improve its buying power. So there's some interesting things to have an eye on there, but it will be a tall order for Walmart.
And let's go to Raymond, who is calling from Woodhaven, Michigan. Raymond, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me. I do roughly 60 to 70% of my shopping online. Both my wife and I are Amazon Prime members and have been for almost our entire marriage, 4 years at least. And I can tell you that Amazon Prime has really just changed the game in our mindset and how we shop. Very rarely do we buy any of our electronics, any kind of even furniture. We bought our bed online. We do a majority of our shopping online. Brick-and-mortar stores, in our opinion, my opinion primarily, are kind of losing that lackluster, especially when return policies and guarantees are just as good online as they are in the brick-and-mortar stores. And the prices tend to be just as competitive. Give an example, my wife and I, for our bed, we looked online for mattresses, and this was the one time that I actually went into a store and saw that the prices online for comparable mattresses rated on Consumer Reports was so much cheaper to purchase online, and we just did that. We are online shoppers, and I am a huge fan of online shopping.
Raymond, is there anything you would not buy online that you would actually go to a store for?
Groceries, all day long. Groceries primarily. But other than that, even electronics, everything. I would really just buy online.
But even your groceries could show up refrigerated, delivered to your door. Why is that different for you?
Well, because we buy a lot of fruit, we buy a lot of produce, and it's one of the few things that I like to see online, or, you know, in the store and feel and touch and look at before I purchase. But anything other than what I'm going to consume, primarily produce and fresh fruits and vegetables, I would certainly advocate purchasing online.
Raymond, thank you very much for that. Let's go to another caller. This is Damien from Nashville, Tennessee. Damien, welcome to On Point.
Hey, just like your previous caller, Raymond, I think my wife and I are very similar to him, been Amazon Prime customers for a long time. We just actually replaced an entire bathroom, sinks, faucets, even downspouts and whatnot from Amazon Prime. Like as your guest was just speaking about, with Jet not having any profitability, I don't see that anywhere whatsoever. But I also don't understand how Amazon is making money, because what we pay for these sinks and for these faucets are such high quality compared to what we would have paid at, say, a Home Depot or Lowe's. It's just amazing. But one question I did want you to ask of your guest is where they're seeing these stores close, such as Macy's closing. Those customers don't seem to me to be the type of customers that do a lot of shopping online. It seems like they will be the ones who are losing out in these closures, because people like Raymond and I probably buying so much online. We're probably in a different demographic and a different economic strata as well. So I was wondering, what do they think when they consider those issues? And as far as what we don't buy online, Raymond said groceries. I don't buy any clothing online whatsoever.
You like to try it on in a dressing room.
That's a loser.
That's interesting. Damien, thanks for that. And that's a good question. Sarah and Mark, could you answer that? You know, Damien raises the point that when you see stores like these legacy department stores close, do those end up disadvantaging a certain kind of shopper, a certain type of customer who may not be an online shopper? Do we see a disparity there?
Well, let me jump in. There is no question that as stores in older communities that are low, middle income close, those shoppers are basically left out in the cold. They have no place else to go. They have to travel a considerable distance if they want to stay affiliated with the department store that might have just closed or the mall that might have just closed. They are not, to your caller's point, typical online shoppers. They may wind up migrating in some way, shape, or form in that regard. But there is a dislocation that occurs, and of course it has a tremendous negative spillover from an economic point of view throughout the community, because it's not just the store and its employees. It's the wages that disappear and all the suppliers, third-party servicers who have some affiliation with that location who suddenly don't have a customer any longer. So this is a rolling disruption that is a very, very, very a very unhappy event in many communities when it occurs.
Sarah Halzack of The Washington Post, would you answer a variation of that question, which is, we've talked about Walmart trying very hard to increase its online sales, and so far it seems to have been a struggle. That's why they spent $3 billion buying a small company that they hope can jumpstart them. Is it possible that Walmart's struggle tells us something about Walmart customers? Could these be, for whatever reason, shoppers less web savvy or less interested in buying online who really want to go to a store?
Perhaps. You know, I think that it's obvious that Walmart has a very loyal customer that's very comfortable doing store shopping and is, you know, has built their routine around that and is willing to continue doing that. But it does seem like Walmart was just slow to this game. They were slow to build out their infrastructure to be able to ship things quickly. They were slow to build out their assortment online. To this day, you can't buy nearly as many things on the Walmart website as you can in a Walmart store in terms of the assortment of items that they have. So they were just slow to ramp up, and they probably just missed out on some of those dollars and are scrambling to try to recapture them now.
On the other hand, Marshall's TJX or Marshall's and TJ Maxx, part of the TJX companies, I believe are sort of notorious for having less online presence than you might think, yet they're thriving. So how do we reconcile that?
Marshall's and TJX and Ross stores, for example, carry a tremendous amount of merchandise that's of the moment. They move inventory very, very quickly through their stores. Their stores represent a treasure hunt of sorts for their loyal customers. It doesn't make sense for them to invest heavily in online because they don't make deep investments in specific merchandise. So they are having a field day taking market share away from these legacy brick-and-mortar retailers like Macy's and Sears and JCPenney.
And they can do that even though people have to go to their stores for the most part to buy their products, or are quite willing to go to their stores to buy their products.
Well, they can do that, and they have thousands of stores, and so they're conveniently located throughout most marketplaces. If I could jump in and comment on the question that an earlier caller asked about how does Amazon make money? You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out ways to lower your costs. I think this $3 billion acquisition of an algorithm is basically bogus. How does Amazon make money? Well, some people think they don't. I think they make enormous amounts of money. They're demonstrating that over the last few quarters. The secret sauce to Amazon is this Amazon Web Service cloud capability that they've created. This is the use of their technology machine that they've been investing in for 20 years to service their own business, that they were smart enough to engineer so as to be able to be offered up as a third-party provider. And so they have outdone the IBMs and the Googles of the world dead to rights. This is an enormously profitable arm of the company, and it's an outgrowth of their retail investments.
And Amazon is certainly a massively data-driven company. You know, they really do so well there.
They've also created this incredibly attractive and lucrative subscription service called Amazon Prime. And the third leg of the stool is their own products, from Kindle to Fire tablets to this new device called Echo. All of which indirectly drive free cash flow and profitability down the bottom
Echo
line.
Echo is sort of an in-house command system where you can sort of talk out loud and it will do what you want. It kind of makes your home very very wired.
It's an expression of the future, and it's enabling them to move away from a just price proposition. You may have noted that they've dropped or are dropping comparative prices. They're not claiming to be the lowest price in all things at all times. So I think Walmart has missed the boat, and there's no way they're going to catch Amazon. The best that they can do is build out a successful omni-channel business on their own. And if they really feel this tremendous need to acquire new and different customers, Jet wasn't a good choice, in my opinion.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the future of finance to the disruptive potential of artificial intelligence, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the changing retail landscape. Join this conversation. Tell us how you decide what you buy online and what you buy in person. Or are you all one or all the other? Can you imagine cities without stores? Do you want to live in a city like that? We're talking with Sarah Halzack, national retail reporter for The Washington Post, and Mark Cohen, director of retail sales at Columbia Business School. Mark is former chairman and CEO of Sears Canada, of Bradley's, and of Lazarus department stores. And Sarah and Mark, we have many, many listeners who want to comment. This is obviously hitting a vein. Shopping is so much a part of our lives and how we do it. Let's hear from several callers, and then we can weigh in on the various points they make. Let's go to Constance, calling from Madison, Connecticut. Constance, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. I'm very glad to hear this program today. I prefer to shop in a retail store when I can see how a style looks on me. Sizes vary by manufacturer and size, fabric quality, construction of a dress. I'm talking specifically about dresses. However, shoes fit differently on different feet, I do feel, and the construction on various shoes that I have bought online has varied considerably. And I find it annoying to have to send it back and wait to get something else that might do just as well.
You're willing to return something to a store, or do you also feel like you can walk out of that store confident it fits you so you won't have to be back?
Mostly I can feel confident that it will fit me. Occasionally I'll get home and look at it again and think, no, but I can go back and pick something out that does without having to wait for the mail.
Constance, is there anything you would buy online?
Very little. Occasionally we buy books or CDs, something like that. I live with an area where there are stores. I live in a semi-rural area, so it's not exactly around the corner. But I just prefer to look and see. I mean, you can go and look at 5, 6, 7 different television sets and think, well, this is what that report says about it. But when you actually go into a retail store and see what they look like, see what the difference is in the picture, you can make a better decision, I feel.
Constance, thanks for that. I think many people share that feeling. Let's go to Gail, calling from Fish Creek, Wisconsin. Gail, welcome to you too, On Point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I used to manage in a very high-end retail back decades ago, and one of my favorite stores besides the one I worked in was Marshall Field.
Another legacy retailer.
Oh, God, it was so great. Their level of quality and their material, their market was wonderful. The service with the people, there was this wonderful a service about how they just treated their customers, and it was just so wonderful. Everything matched the quality level of everything they sold, and then Macy's bought them. And there were so many of us that we actually mourned the fact that Marshall Field's was gone, because what was going to be gone was that edge of service, that wonderful quality, and you could buy things that would periodically have sales, but it wasn't cheap stuff. And this Marshall's that's going on now, that trend, that's really cheaper quality stuff. People think they are getting really good quality stuff. It's not. It's cheap stuff.
Or maybe they don't think they're getting good quality, but they only want to wear it a few times, and that's okay with them.
No. It started when Lord & Taylor used to have one shop, and one year they would have a big sale. Then they created an end of line off store, like their little outlet store. That was high quality stuff. Then that caught in on marketing, and marketing went with it, and other store chains started to do it, and they would get lower quality stuff and put it in those stores to give people the brand, giving them the impression that it was high quality stuff, and the quality level of clothing and other things started to tank.
I think that's true. I think it's just a matter of whether some people are willing to, whether they're fine with that. Gail, can you tell us whether you do any shopping online?
No, I don't.
And is that, do you think that's generational?
No, I don't. I think it's multifaceted, because there are some people who don't have the computer ability, or they don't even have credit cards, or they don't want credit cards, or they just know that they just have a way of wanting to, like the previous caller, wanting to try it on, wanting to know the construction. That's all part of a level of quality. But you can tell by the feel of a material, if it's going to launder well, how you have to take care, how you have to maintain it. And if you're going to want to just buy something to wear a few times and you don't care if it turns into a rag while you're wearing it after a half a dozen washes, then you're wasting your money. because the higher quality material is going to last longer. It's going to wear. It's not going to pill. You're not going to get fiber coming out of it, and eventually you've got a piece of material that is so paper thin that it doesn't hold its shape.
Right. Gail, thank you for that. Let's go to one other caller before we go back to our guests, and this is Fred calling from Montgomery, Alabama. Fred, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. One thing I haven't heard about in this discussion is I don't even look at, like, brand-new retail stuff anymore. I just go to eBay or the Goodwill at shopgoodwill.com. They have an excellent storefront that takes all the Goodwills across the country, and you can shop each one individually, exactly what you want, on eBay. The car that I'm driving right now, I bought from eBay for $4,000 or $5,000 cheaper than I could find it at a used car lot. The mattress that I sleep on at night, I bought online without sleeping on it because they have I think it's a 100-day return policy for free. The pants that I'm wearing, you know, I can pinpoint exactly what I want and not have to go to a store and, like, the stores I've gone to lately, you know, it's so hard to find things, you know, and I don't have to worry about a sale at shopping, like, on eBay or other used sites.
So for you, it's both you can avoid going to a store and you feel like you get a better deal than you might have at the store.
Exactly. And then I can pinpoint the exact size of pants and shirts that I want, and I don't have to go in there wondering if they're going to have the style that I want with the size that I want.
Fred, thank you for that. That's really interesting. And, you know, Sarah Halzack of The Washington Post and Mark Cohen of Columbia Business School, Fred does raise an interesting point, which is you can go to Goodwill. You know, of course, some people are never going to do that, but it does show us this shift towards wanting a deal. I also want to play a little piece of sound, which is of Forever 21, the chain store, and it asked three models what they like about the store. Here was their response, and this comes from a video that the retail chain posted online.
Go in there and find, like,
a whole
guaranteed
wardrobe.
Something.
Yeah.
Plus, it's really stylish and really comfortable, which I'm massive about.
Now, Forever 21 would fall into the category of what some people call fast fashion. You know, they're very quick at turning around stylish, contemporary designs. And this, as we heard from Gail, these are clothes that may not last long, but I don't think that really bothers some consumers. Can you tell us, Mark and Sarah, your thoughts about people willing to maybe compromise quality in return for a good deal for something they only want to wear for maybe a season?
I think this reflects how much the fashion landscape has changed in recent years and the extent to which social media has shaped how quickly we can get our hands on that imagery. So I think that we're now in this world where you don't have to wait for the Vogue magazine or the Cosmopolitan magazine to land in your mailbox to tell you what's cool and what's hip. And with Instagram, with Facebook, with Twitter, with this constant access to celebrities and to fashion designers, with runway shows showing us in real time their latest pieces, we really have this unprecedented access to fashion and to trends, and it's fueled up immensely how quickly they move and how quickly a hot look goes boom and goes bust. These fast fashion outlets allow everyday people to capitalize on that. So if you want to jump on the crop top trend, but you know you're only probably going to be on it for about 1 month, it probably does make sense to only spend $10 on it on Forever 21. And that's why retailers of that ilk, H&M, Zara, have done so well in this moment.
Mark Cohen, it seems that there are mixed messages being sent from and to the retail sector. We've talked about Macy's closing 100 stores. Sports Authority has closed. Yet TJ Maxx and Marshall's thriving. Express is opening outlet stores in regular malls. We've seen Nordstrom and Macy's open lower price versions of themselves, like Nordstrom Rack and Macy's Backstage. There's so much going on. Is it that the stores that tend to do the cheaper, discounted, but still trendy things do well? I mean, how do we reconcile all this?
There's a Darwinian shift that's taking place from retailing of old, which 40 or 50 years ago was shopping in downtown department stores, to 20 to 40 years ago shopping in shopping malls, to the presence of the internet, which essentially exposes virtually everything that a consumer would ever consider buying at almost any price point available at their fingertips, if not just to shop, certainly to examine. I think that this shift that's occurring is going to be ongoing, and the legacy retailers like Macy's and others will either have to figure out how to transform themselves into something that's not only more viable to their customer base but more profitable, or they're going to dwindle and die. We have a tremendously diverse universe of consumers with very different budget capacity, with very different fashion outlook, with very different expectations. And it's probably true that no retailer like a Macy's, which used to do business with quote-unquote everyone, can survive in that same vein, at least not as a brick-and-mortar store. The beauty of Amazon is they're fashion, style, price agnostic. You can buy very inexpensive things. You can buy very expensive things. They make it about as convenient as you can conceivably make it, granted that you're not able to actually touch, feel, and try something on. But their fast shipping and easy returns seem to satisfy millions and millions of customers in that regard. I think the shift is going to continue to play out over the next 5 to 10 years, and the landscape is going to be very different when this is quote-unquote over. And many of these retail powerhouses may very well disappear in that period of time.
Sarah Halzack, do you see a future where there may be drastically fewer stores than there are now? Most people shop online, sort of similar to how fewer and fewer newspapers land on doorsteps and more people get their news online. Is that where we are inevitably headed?
I think so. I think we're definitely heading toward a great reckoning on store count. So, you know, Macy's is at 675 full-line stores right now. Kohl's still has over 1,000 stores. Gap has 866 North American stores. Old Navy has over 1,000 stores in North America. That is just too many for the era that we're in now. And I think you will see a rationalization. I think probably more around 300 stores per chain is probably where we'll end up. That would mean you could be in the sort of upper tier, very productive malls and be pulled out of some of these mausoleum type malls like you described earlier, those sort of smaller regional malls that are dying. I think that's the future we're headed towards.
Let's go back to some callers. This is Brad calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Brad, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Sasha. So I have 24 years of retail big box experience, mainly with Circuit City, which I'm sure you all remember from back in the day.
Of course.
And I think the big decline in the customer not visiting the store anymore has two key factors. The first is poor hiring and training. We're hiring associates and putting them in stores, and that think it's okay to check their cell phone or have side conversations or do things other than show a sense of urgency about that consumer's needs. I know Nordstrom Rack was mentioned earlier, and, you know, it's a TJX brand type of experience. But walk into one of those. Walk into a TJX and look around, and then walk into a Nordstrom Rack. And you can't walk into a Nordstrom Rack without seeing order and symmetry and people that are nice and genuinely want to help you with anything. And I think that environment is what's missing from a brick-and-mortar store, and that's who's going to continue to be successful in that landscape, is stores that can develop a culture where the customer and the customer's needs come first.
Brad, thank you for that. Interesting to hear that from someone who does have a retail management background. Before we finish up this hour, Sarah and Mark, I want to talk a little bit about how high-tech Amazon has become and how that helps it. Let's listen to a piece of sound that Amazon put out. It's a video they used to demonstrate how its drones might work. They predicted a future when a young girl whose dog ate one of her cleats could get a new pair of cleats within a half an hour. Here's English broadcaster Jeremy Clarkson narrating.
After rising vertically like a helicopter to nearly 400 feet, this amazing hybrid design assumes a horizontal orientation and becomes a streamlined and fast airplane. In time, there'll be a whole family of Amazon drones, different designs for different environments. This one can fly for 15 miles.
Mark Cohen, Amazon has estimated that it could cut in half the unit cost of its deliveries if it did that, so you can certainly see the incentive. And with Amazon owning so much of this market, it's really had to focus on how do we get things to people quickly. It started this fleet of 40 Boeing 767s. They're calling them Amazon One. It's basically creating its own air transportation network. Give us a sense, Mark, of how innovative and ahead Amazon is in this area, and can anyone ever catch up with that?
Amazon is enormously innovative, but Amazon is also enormously intelligent in the way they're going about expanding their business. I'm sure that there will be a day in your listeners' lifetimes when drones will actually be delivering packages, but at the moment, this is a tremendously exciting PR pitch. The real heavy lifting that's going on is the ever-increasing network of distribution centers that Amazon has been investing in across the country, and their ability to move merchandise almost immediately toward customers. So customers who pay for Prime membership get two-day shipping, but often, as I've discovered in New York, that package arrives a day, not 2 days later. They're buying 767s to be able to move merchandise in bulk between their distribution center sites to balance their inventories. They've also got a fleet of their own trucks in the Bay Area, which are actually delivering their own merchandise. I don't know so much as to think that this is an attempt by Amazon to actually become a FedEx or UPS, but I do know they're using this investment to make it very clear to FedEx and UPS, who are their enormously connected logistics partners, that if they don't work with them in contract negotiations, they can do without them.
Oh, that's interesting, that they could sort of not even need UPS, FedEx, U.S. Postal Service. They can just have their own in-house service. That's quite interesting. It is a pretty, it's a lot of leverage for them to have when they're negotiating. That's quite interesting. Mark Cohen, thank you so much for joining us this hour. Mark is Director of Retail Sales at Columbia Business School, and he's former chairman and CEO of Sears Canada, Bradley's, and Lazarus Department Stores. Also with us this hour has been Sarah Halzack, National Retail Reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you very much to both of you.
Thank you.
And listeners, even though this hour is coming to an end, you can keep the conversation going and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.